You meet all the top people,
mm-hmm.
you see.
A marvelous tour.
Oh, tremendous.
Yeah.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
And you couldn't have funded such a thing yourself as a private individual. You just couldn't have done it. And you wouldn't have met the people anyway, you know. Under our
yeah.
aegis,
yeah.
you met the top people. I remember watching somebody's face, and he, I'd not long before this, gone to India, Pakistan, etc., etc. And this man mentioned Ayub Khan. And I said, oh, yes, I met him. We talked for half an hour one day. And he looked a little surprised, and he moved on to New Delhi. And I said, oh, yeah, well, we had a good session with Nehru. And the vice president of India, who was a charming old gentleman, this guy was really wondering what on earth. Who was I that had known all
yeah.
these people?
Yeah. Oh,
of course I wouldn't have met them if it hadn't
no.
been under these aegis. And on that occasion, I was the tour leader, so that I was sort of the interlocutor, if you will. The whole group of us were visiting Ayub Khan, but I was the head boy, so I started the ball rolling and so on.
Oops.
Right.
Okay, here we go now.
Well, because it is a very flossy tour, and so on, as we say, but they're of great value. When we came back, we had a usual critique of the things, and each syndicate was encouraged to make its comments on the tour, whether it's value or not, and so on. What their impressions were of Krishna Menon, for instance, who we tangled with in Delhi. Tangled is the right word, too, because he's a very argumentative gent, he was. And we had a very argumentative fellow in our group, and they went out in hammer and tongs at the Indian Defense College, who hosted this session and their facilities. And it was very interesting. The man was mad, I'm sure. Krishna Menon.
Were they?
Oh, well, by our standards.
At least erratic, anyway.
Erratic is all, yeah. Yes. I think by his standards, he was a pretty good guy, but didn't fit our standards.
Huh.
It was most interesting to listen to this funny fellow expound. But, and so on, all these things. Ben Gurion, we met.
Oh, did
you?
Yeah.
In Israel. And another group met Nasser in Egypt. I didn't go on that one. But, so, you know, you met the top people.
Yeah.
And it doesn't do you any harm to be exposed to this sort of thing. You find often in subsequent situations that it hasn't hurt at all to have been able to say that you spoke to so and so. It sometimes helps your entree to some situation.
Mm-hmm. Makes you somewhat of a figure of entitled to some respect or some consideration.
Right. I suppose so.
Wouldn't otherwise have had.
Yeah. Yes. It's one of those things you can't quite define, but it's there. And I've known, and other people have told me, the fact that you're wearing a National Defense College tie has occasionally opened a door, because the person who's looking at you and sort of being rather critical suddenly notices what tie you've got, and he says, oh, well, I was there in 1953 now. Who was there with you?
Do come in and sit down.
Exactly.
Yes, right. Yeah.
There was a reception in Bangkok, for instance, and the man was making a presentation to us. And I looked across the room to my astonishment. There was an NDC tie. He's a member of the American mission to Thailand.
Oh, for goodness
sake. And after all the speeches and stuff were over, I went over and talked to him, and I found that we had indeed met. He was just finishing his course when I was joining the staff, and we'd met for about 10 minutes and 50
yards.
So, you know, this is, the net spreads wide.
Who's at the old school tie in there, eh?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
It's a very valuable adjunct sometimes.
Yeah.
And if you wear it selectively, it's pretty useful. And I've often found that to be the case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did you enjoy this?
Well,
I mean, this whole period. I mean,
fascinating. Yes. We had most of the summer off, which was nice for the family, you know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, our last... No, we didn't. We had about 5 weeks off, I guess. We ended in July and we started again in September. But that 5 weeks is more than you ever do get in a normal service environment. And you didn't have all of that, because before the end you were starting back into the office gently, part-time, to get things ready for the incoming course. But it meant that you had more family time than in most jobs. But during the school year, you were pretty busy, and you didn't really see an awful lot of the family, because you were away so much time.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah.
We toured around the Arctic as well, too, for instance. Cambridge Bay is 45 below with a 30 knot wind. Well, I don't recommend it.
No.
But it's interesting to have experienced it. Mm. Boy, you ran like a rigger to get out of it.
Yeah, you did.
I slept out in the barrens at Churchill, and 45 below with no wind. That was quite cold enough. If there had been a wind, I don't suppose we'd have been allowed to do it, because it would have been stupid. I think it was pretty stupid anyway, but I'm glad I did it, just as an experience. I hated every second of it at the time, but I did it because I thought I ought to.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
So it really was the National Defense College, then, is, you know, serves a very useful purpose to senior members of the forces.
And
really gives them an appreciation.
And government.
And
industry, as I say. We weren't as successful at attracting industry in my day as they have been subsequently, I understand. The problem is that the people that we wanted there was the up-and-coming young executive who was going to be going up his ladder, and we wanted him for a year when he was lost to that company. So it's got to be a pretty long-sighted company who will let that right guy go for a year in order to do this vague sort of thing. As I say, I understand they've been more successful in doing it. But that has been a great thing, because it has exposed the military to the civilian and the civilian to the military at an executive level. Great stuff. So there should be more of it. I mean, wish now that this kind of a caper had been done on a larger scale for a longer time. Because this is one of the reasons, one of our problems today in Canada is obviously that the public don't know enough about the military and don't understand the problems of defense and don't care. And if they did, we might have a stronger defense establishment now than we have got.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all leaven, it's yeast, and works, maybe, but there's not enough of it. Anyway, as far as the NDC itself is concerned, it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. Still is for the country.
Yeah, right. So what, then after you had you finished your tour on the directing staff there, what happened?
I went back to sea. I became the senior Canadian officer afloat Atlantic and a commodore, and I mostly blew my broad pennant in Bonaventure, the carrier, but I shifted around to other ships from time to time. And that was good. That was a good job. That's a good job. It still goes, but of course we haven't got a carrier, and that made a big deal of difference.
Yes, I suppose you really were living in some style aboard the carrier. Presumably you had a reasonable set of cabins. And
yes.
Or quite some,
mm-hmm.
I mean, not that they, I think even destroyer cabins, the captain's cabins were pretty, pretty nice, really.
Yes, they were, very.
But not as
spacious as...
Quite as palatial as...
But the Admiral's cabin in Bonaventure was really very large. He had a large day cabin and a reasonable-sized sleeping cabin in the bathroom aft. And, of course, in his sea cabin, he had a sleeping cabin and a bathroom up in the superstructure, up near, above the Bispo of the Bridge, above the flight deck, of course. And so he moved far. He moved up there at sea,
mm-hmm.
slept up there at sea, and slept aft in harbour.
Well, it was a hell of a long way from swinging a hammock in a gun room, eh?
Yes, I guess you might say that.
Yeah.
A bit of a chain. Yeah. Well, progress, I suppose.
Yeah.
That was fun. Yeah,
was it?
A good job.
Hmm. And presumably, of course, you... presumably you had your own steward and that sort of thing.
Oh, yes.
And you had,
yeah, he traveled around with me.
Yeah.
And a staff, most of whom traveled with me. When I moved from ship to ship, if the other ship could accommodate. And for the most part they could, because I didn't ever go for a long time to a ship, particularly a destroyer, because I knew it was an awful strain on them to have all these people suddenly put on.
Yeah.
And I needed some of my staff, depending on what we were doing. I'd need this one, that one, but not that one, you know, for a few days, depending on what we were doing. Flag Lieutenant tended to come with me all the time, but because he's sort of partly a personal... helper, ADC type thing, and partly a professional, he's a communications officer, as is normal situation in the Navy at some levels of Admiralty. And I had a chief, staff officer who was the general SOO and so on and so on, and I had a Tasmanologist and I had an aviator. Well, the aviator I usually borrowed from down at Bonaventure, actually, and I had a secretary who was also a supply officer. But, in fact, the aviator, funnily enough, was the fellow who is now Admiral Robert Falls, who's just...
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was Commander Air of Bonaventure in those days, and he was my aviation advisor.
Had you had anything to do with the air element before, or this time?
Not really, only spasmodically and so on. I'd never served in a carrier before, and I was always terribly intrigued with the air, and had there been an air arm in the RCN when I was an acting sub, for instance, I'm sure I would have gone into it, because it was something that attracted me immensely. But there wasn't, so I didn't. So it was really a pleasure to me to come, but I was still a fish head to them, and I was therefore suspect until they discovered that I really did have a certain amount of sympathy for their problems, and indeed some sort of an understanding of it, I guess. So we got on very well, and I enjoyed them, and they enjoyed me, I hope. They were always very polite to me anyway. We had a large fleet in those days in Bermuda at one time. We used to go south every winter for exercises, of course, in the best traditions. And Bermuda was our base some of the time, where the weather is always atrocious at this time of year in January. I don't know if you know, but it is. People think Bermuda is always sunny and warm. It isn't at all, I tell you. It's absolutely foul at times. And while we were there, instead of further south, I forget now, but I think our planning practice, or our logistics, wouldn't allow us to go further south. Or if we did go further south, we then had to depend on the kindness of the USN, and we already pumped them dry all the time.
All the time, yeah.
Always leaning on them for something, which is terribly embarrassing. But we had to, because we didn't have the facilities ourselves. Anyway, I had 26 ships under my command, including auxiliaries, granted, you know, tugs and store lighters and things like that. And it was rather fun in that I was calling on the governor, who was an immense fellow called Gascoigne, one day, and it was just before HMS Bermuda was to come in with the Vice Admiral Hamilton on board. And HMS Bermuda was about to be paid off, and since the Admiral's name was Hamilton, which is also the name of the capital of Bermuda, it was too good for the Admiralty. They sent her out to do her farewell visit to the colony. And the governor said to me, "Stirling, how is it that you have 26 ships and you're only a commodore? And Admiral Hamilton is coming in tomorrow. He's a vice admiral, and he's only got one ship." I said, "Your Excellency, I think you'd better ask the Admiralty. I don't know." Well, you know, it did look a bit queer.
Yeah.
And everybody, in fact, all of the Midlands commented on it, and the Admiral, Gallo wasn't all that pleased. Comparison being drawn.
No, I think not.
Very civil to me, personally, but I left, or he left. We left before he did, actually.
He was probably glad to see the end of you.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah. Upstage the best.
You bet. We enjoyed it because every time the RCN has ever been, my knowledge, been in Bermuda when our own ships were there, we were upstage for fairly well. And reminded how colonial we really were. And so on. Picked it before the war.
I bet it was.
I can remember Victor Brodeur spitting tacks out of the situation.
I think he was a chap who could do it very well.
Yes, he was taken to task one day, and I never turned to this.
But no, I think so.
Lying there with the Canadian Navy, because you have four ships, he was flying senior officer's pennant, and the Admiral Sir Matthew Best was there as a rear admiral, and he admonished for flying a senior officer's pennant in his port, where his flag was flying. And Brodeur's reply was, "The Canadian Navy is different," which was and is and so on. Up to a point, he was right, and up to another point, he was wrong. But he was different, he was Canadian, and he really was rather fed up with being patronized by the Brits.
Mm-hmm.
And he made it known. And this is one of the reasons why Victor Brodeur had the reputation of being very prickly.
Yeah.
He wasn't very prickly in our circles, he was very prickly in international circles because he was standing up for Canada. Well, I guess that his contemporaries in the Canadian Navy in those days weren't famous for doing that. So
he stood out.
But
yeah.
I was a dandy. He was a dandy guy. Dandy fellow.
Okay.
He beat me to death on several occasions when I was an acting sub-lieutenant, and I told him I was serving under him, and he was tough but fair. And at the very end of his days I knew him as such too.
Well,
all these vessels you had running around the Atlantic, surely that must have been about the biggest Canadian fleet that had ever taken the seas at one lump.
Since the war, yeah. We had, I guess, a very large proportion of it. Let me see now. I had a squadron of minesweepers coming to the bottom up. I had a squadron of minesweepers, a squadron of frigates, and squadron of destroyers, or DDEs, and Cape Scott or a pair come store ship.
Yeah. No, yeah. Liberty ship. Didn't see the Cape Scott? Liberty ship, or that sort of thing?
Park, I think she was a park.
Park ship, yeah, something like that.
And Bonaventure. Don't ask me the numbers of the ships in the various squadrons, so I don't remember. But this is what we had there.
Mm-hmm.
Plus some auxiliaries, as I said. So, yeah, it was a formidable group of ships and a large number of people.
I should say. I told you that you would exercise in all ways and in all forms.
Everything you think of was going on, yeah.
Yeah. What sort of aircraft did the Bonaventure carry in those? Was this about 1950, what, 6, 7?
No, this was 50... No, it wasn't. It was 61. 61, 62.
Oh, was it?
Mm-hmm.
What sort of...
Trackers.
Oh, yeah, they had the trackers then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Banshee had just been phased out just before I came, the jet fighters. It was decided that we didn't need our own combat air patrol, which was absolute nonsense, but there it was. That was a political decision.
Yeah, who...
we were told we didn't need our own cap. Well, of course...
who was going to provide it?
What?
Who was going to provide it?
Oh, exactly, that's what we said.
Oh, I see.
Oh, you always get the man to look at it, you know, da-da-da. Or the Brits, if you happen to be in company with Ark Royal or somebody. So, we were left without any submarine aircraft. Very useful, but not the whole picture.
Well, certainly it wasn't much good for protecting your base or your carrier, was it?
No, not against that, Jack.
And that was, I guess that was the conservative government period, was that?
61?
Still,
Yeah, I guess one.
Diefenbaker still?
Yes, I guess one. When did he,
Well, I think that was about the end of his time, pretty well. I think they changed in... Was it 62 that Pearson came in? It was just about the end. It may have...
63, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it must
be. I must say I forget.
That's true, isn't that a shocker? No, Diefenbaker government was still in power in late 62 when I went up to Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember the minister was Doug Harkness. He was a good guy. He tried.
And I suppose it was simply a matter of they had to... The budget was cut, and you had to cut something,
yeah.
And then these aircraft were pretty expensive, I guess.
Well, and they were long in the tooth, too.
Yeah.
They were due for replacement, and I guess they were World War II aircraft, for heaven's sake.
Well, pretty close after.
Yeah.
I don't think they were...
I don't know if they actually got into the battle.
No.
But they must have been very close by afterwards. No, they didn't, because they were jets, yeah. Right, we didn't have any jets.
No.
But... It was a sadness, but actually in a carrier the size of Bonaventure, you're probably better off to concentrate on one form of aircraft, because having a mixed bag meant a mixed bag of mechanics, a mixed bag of fuel,
mm-hmm.
a mixed bag of everything you can think of, because the two were not, in any way interchangeable, nor were any of their spare parts, so it made your spares problem very, very, very tough.
Didn't have helicopters in those days?
Yeah.
Well, you did?
Mm-hmm. Well, we only had helicopters for rescue purposes.
Oh, yeah.
And that whenever you were flying, you had a helicopter out there waiting to pick up anybody who went in a drink. And they could be good they were, too. But we didn't have any submarine helicopters in that at that time. They were just coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Like we were doing we'd been doing the deck landing trials and for some time, and the bear trap method of holding down when they landed on destroyers. And I don't remember when the first anti-submarine helicopters actually hit the fleet. It was after this. I went along on some of the trials when I was CANCOM fleet, I think.
At some time I did. I guess it was then.
Must have been.
Did you do a lot of anti-submarine exercise on your own, sort of off, almost flying exercise, rather than, distinct from, say, fleet maneuvering,
mm-hmm.
did you sort of traipse off out of Halifax to mm-hmm. do this kind of work mm-hmm. a great deal? Or? Mm-hmm.
Quite a lot. And down off New London. Again, the Americans were very kind. Off their main submarine base, you know, in New London, Connecticut. They helped us a lot. And they helped our individual ships and destroyer squadrons and so on. And then when we'd go further south to somewhere like Guantanamo or Puerto Rico, they produced submarines for us there, too. Mm-hmm. So we had submarine time there.
Presumably, we had one, I guess.
Yeah.
One submarine?
Yes, I forgot her name now.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. There was something I was going to ask, and I thought of it a minute ago. Ah. Was there any discussion then in regard to the Bonaventure or an aircraft carrier being a great drain on the finances of the Department of National Defense? Was there any feeling in that way at all?
I guess there probably was, but not to the extent that you couldn't defend against it.
Yeah.
The Treasury boys were always bothered about this by this thing, and of course she was old. Her hull was old, as you know. She's built as rich and as powerful and never commissioned. And she'd sat in Belfast for quite a long time before she was finished. So some of her wiring and some of her general condition was less than desirable. And
did that ever become a major problem?
Oh, yeah. Well, this would cause her demise in the final analysis, yes. Because the refits that she did were always patch-ups. They were never proper. We could never get enough money to do a proper one. Just as happened in the final end. She was hard to keep going, and it was hard work for her ship's company to keep her going all the time, particularly the electricians. Always chasing faults in the electrical circuits all the time. And some of them, not only was the wiring physically old, the wiring schemes were old. They were out of date.
Yes.
And you put all sorts of new equipment into these ships, and then you tried to make them go with funny old supply lines, which were built to supply something entirely different and rather more basic. So it was a great effort. They kept her going magnificently. But every now and then you get a problem. You know, always had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a pretty good ship.
Was she suitable for what you were doing? I mean, apart from the mechanical, was she suitable to design and that sort of thing, and had the necessary speed and the abilities that you required from that point of view?
She couldn't keep up with the fleet. She was too slow again. And then so were her escorts by design, as we've just been discussing. But these light fleet carriers were built during the war on a cheap and nasty basis, and they were going to be operating in their own environ. They were not going to be operating with the fast fleet group. They would be operating with a slow fleet group on purpose because they were cheaper to build. They couldn't go on building Ark Royals, for instance, mm-hmm. or what have you. So they built these smaller ones and slower ones, churn them out quicker. Well, if we'd had our choice, I think we'd have gone for something like an Essex-class, U.S. Essex-class carrier, which is a little bit bigger, would have been able to have two kinds of aircraft, a larger ship's company, a more expensive operation, a much faster ship, pros and cons all the time, you always have. You've never got a clear-cut situation when you're talking about ships. And you have to weigh it against the political and the financial considerations. Mm-hmm. Well, we almost got an Essex one day. I don't know what stopped it. I don't know what got us so close to grabbing the brass ring. But I was told that we very, very nearly got one as a replacement for Bonaventure. It didn't happen. It may have been the change of government we were just talking about. I don't remember, but I don't think so, because I was in Ottawa then. I think it was during the Conservative regime that this occurred.
They were very good ships, I've been given to understand,
yeah.
The Essex-class.
Yeah.
They were very...
Particularly the modernized ones that had angled decks. The basic ones were a little old hat, but...
Yeah.
One of them actually had an angled deck, you see, and mirror landing system, which was great stuff, modern, in that respect, is one of the few things in which she was modern. And
some of the Americans didn't have as good a system as was the British system. But, no, she was a good ship,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
for her role. Trackers were slow, but then we were going into the Sea Kings, you see, at this time. The helicopters, I remember the helicopter squadron commander delighted when he heard we were going. After all this nattering, we were going to go for them. He said he could fly, when he got those, he could fly higher, lower, faster, and slower than any other ship, any other aircraft that we had. And he was just smacking his chops. It didn't happen during my time, but they came in for the destroyers. But no, I don't think we ever got a squadron here. A ship born in Bonaventure before she went to the war. Don't think so, not sure.
Yeah. And she was scrapped then?
Oh, sometime later, yeah. yeah. She wasn't scrapped until about, 65 or 66
yeah.
or something like that.
Yeah.
Quite a bit later.
Yeah.
Oh, all of that, no. 70.
Yeah, I guess it was quite late. Yeah. We managed to keep her going for that extra, eight years more,
yeah.
sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's rather odd, I guess you were the Navy at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been a bit of a question mark, I suppose. It this very expensive refit was done, and then she basically was chucked out.
And that,
was that a political decision largely?
Oh, entirely.
Entirely?
Yeah. Well, they tried to make us the fall guys about this thing.
Mm-hmm.
After I left being Bonaventure, being CAN complete, I was promoted to Rear Admiral. I went to Ottawa as the Chief of Naval Personnel, and as such, I was a second member of the Naval Board.
Mm-hmm.
So we sat at the Naval Board meetings where the ultimate decisions regarding the naval policy below that of the Minister in the Cabinet was made. Well, I can remember perfectly clearly the Chief of Naval Technical Services telling the Board that he had told the Deputy Minister that Bonaventure's major refit was going to cost at least $14.5 million. And the Deputy Minister said, you can only have 8. And he said, well, I'm telling you that it's going to cost $14.5 million to do that job. And the Deputy Minister said, all right, you've told me. Now, that is not what came out.
Mm-hmm. No, it isn't.
Afterwards, in all those gory investigations.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because that Deputy Minister didn't give evidence. And that Chief of Naval Technical Services was out of the service by then, and he's dead now. And the man, the naval officer who was pilloried, Mac Lynch, Captain Lynch, was not even there. And if anything he knew about, this situation was only hearsay and therefore not probably admissible. So the Navy was really screwed on that one. Really. It was a shocker. There's nothing that one could do about it. I suppose had I been in Ottawa, I might have asked, can I appear before the committee? But as you say, I was out of the service then. In fact, I was in England, working for the BC government, I think, when this took place. But, again, what weight would I have carried in such a discussion as a retired naval officer? I don't know. And probably discredited one, too, because of the manner of my departure. It was always so annoying and aggravating when I had this political Roman holiday going on in Ottawa, once again pillorying the Navy, which is usually being pilloried by politicians in recent years, particularly.
Well, I don't know so much that it was, in my mind, it wasn't so much the cost of the refit, it was the fact that one did it and threw it away.
Yeah, but don't you see that what I'm trying to say is we said that this refit is going to cost $14.5 million, and they said, you're going to have 8. And then they said, you didn't tell us that it was going to be so expensive. Why didn't you tell us? It was your duty to inform us.
Right.
Well, we had.
Yeah.
That's my whole point.
Well, I appreciate that.
So then they said, we can't have $5.5 million more dollars to do this job, so we'll do it up to X dollars. I don't know what they did finally spend. Probably it was more than 8, but I don't know.
I forget
that. And then they said, well, we don't want it anyway. Kaput, another political decision, without valid staffing, without the Navy having an input into it.
I suppose they considered they'd spent the money. Anyway.
Mind, by this time it wasn't the Navy either.
No, I suppose they were trying to cut down again. Somebody made another decision.
That's right.
We've got to cut. We've spent that money, and it's too bad, but It's going to cost us so many millions a year to keep her going, mm-hmm. and...
That's right.
Chop.
Can't afford it. Bean. The effect on the operational efficiency of the maritime arm of the Canadian Armed Forces, or whatever the hell it's called, was not a calculation. It was not a part of the calculation.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. Right.
Nobody cared about that. And nobody cares much about it now. Well, a little bit more than they did.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Pretty tight.
Probably going to stop it.
Well,
about time I got a ticket again.
No, I don't know. Let's try it for another 10 minutes. If you don't mind, then we'll run with this tape. Then we'll cope with a ticket if you get one. If you don't mind, just finish this off. And then, then okay, well, as Chief of Naval Personnel at that time, what sort of problems were you experiencing? And I ask this, I told you, I think I talked to... Norman Ross, who in fact was somewhere around that period, was in the Army recruiting, may not have been exactly contemporary with you, but you know, I've heard some of his problems, and I'd like to hear the Naval problems in recruiting, or in, if that was part of the Naval personnel, I presume it was.
Oh, indeed, sure thing.
And what sort of problems you acquired had that period?
Mm-hmm.
This again would have been 1964?
I was CNP from 62 to 64. In 64, I came out here as the Admiral.
Yeah.
So during my time as CNP, yes, recruiting was a problem. What was more of a problem, I think, was the retention rate. The conditions of service were really under survey all this time. That is to say, a man signed on for 5 years. If you could get him to sign on again for another 5, you probably had him, because after you'd spent 10 years in the service, there was not much point in trying somewhere else, unless Mum said so. Of course, one of our great problems always was what the wife said.
Yeah,
the wife
really
was a factor, and I suppose you can't blame them, but it was very aggravating if you're trying to plan careers and plan services. We played together very closely in... Paul Herrier never thought so, but the Personnel Members Committee, which was comprised of the Chief of Naval Personnel, the Adjutant General, and the Air Member for Personnel, and a representative from the Deputy Minister's Office, were the chief personnel leaders of the defense establishment. And we rubbed off on each other a lot. We sort of sounded each other out on what their problems were and whether we had the same things and so on. We also fought a great deal, too, because we were proud of our own thing, and, you know, there was a lot of internecine strife, I know, it's quite true. Not as much as people say there was, but there was some. Our own problem, I guess, personnel-wise, was always the same one. It was to recruit the men, and to train them, and keep them trained, and then keep them in the service, and the same thing with officers, to a certain extent. It was always a case of not having enough money and consequently not being able to recruit enough people, and consequently you never had enough people to man the ships, and consequently you could not fulfill your designated tasks.
So I remember ships here in particular, well, only here, which were still in commission but with very reduced crews.
Yeah.
Just skeleton crew virtually.
Yeah.
And yet, you kept them going.
You kept them going somehow or other, yes. It was really rather scratchy.
I don't know what we do if you had to go to sea and do anything very serious. But,
Well, you got to sea, but you couldn't do anything very serious. You couldn't go and fight a war
or anything
like that. You'd have to rape everybody else in order to send that ship out, or those two ships out, or whatever. It was really not unlike the original days of Korea when the first two or three ships went off to Korea. They took men from everybody else, in order to flash them out to...
get a wartime ship's company.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We had to have done the same thing. We were running down all the time. I don't remember what our dictated ceiling was, but we had a very great difficulty in holding to whatever level we actually were at, regardless of what the ceiling was. And I think we were less than the ceiling. At the same time, if I remember correctly, we were encouraged to run down, but we were not encouraged to reduce our commitments.
Yes. Did you have problems in selection? In other words,
If it was just bodies you wanted, you might have got them, but the fact is, under those circumstances, you probably had a very high proportion of people who would be have to be turfed out after a short time, and then you were sort of had this problem that you couldn't recruit a good enough quality of man. Is this a factor?
Yeah, it's a factor. Our recruiting standards were, I don't know what they were, but they were fairly tough. We were tougher than the Army, certainly, and we were, and as the Air Force, too, I think. But we thought it was justification. When we did get them, yes, there were some bad hats, bad apples in it, and you had to file them out for one reason or another, whether they just weren't the people or whether they were naughty or what. But this is something that's been with us all the time. It was always one of the problems at Cornwallis when I was commanding there. That you almost certainly were processing people out in small numbers, so quite small numbers, or as fast as you're accruing them in large numbers, which is a rather Irish statement, I hope you follow it.
Yes, I do. but it is naturally... speaks well for the selection process before they come, before they went there, if you only had so few to throw out after. And you mentioned the problems of mum and the family. I understand in some cases there was some degree of hardships, particularly on junior ranks who had families. Suddenly he was shipped off somewhere, which I suppose you tried to keep to a very minimum, but it was a bit of a problem because you couldn't afford to... It doesn't matter what the services do, it's going to cost you, the man, money to move, isn't it? I mean, you must have moved many times to know that very well.
Yes.
It does cost you.
Moving lands never covers it.
No.
That's quite true. It was difficult. It was difficult. But then this time, you see, also, we had the home port division system. If a man died and say he was going to be a Halifax man for the rest of his life, or a Scramble man for the rest of his life, that's what he was.
There's very little cross-posting
between the two ports.
I see.
Very little.
And so you've got to a...
Well, quite high rank. And chiefs and POs sometimes, well, because the schools that we've discussed briefly before had to be manned from both coasts, obviously, because both coasts had to have an input into the training picture.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they had to be able to draw from the schools. So when you got to the higher levels, and when you became about the officer level, they had to be capable of moving from coast to coast on special assignments, but not as a general routine. So, yes, it was difficult for men, very much so.
Yeah.
As was for junior officers.
The same
with junior officers. This, again, was one of our problems as part of our society today. They never get married so young.
Yes, the old thing where you couldn't get married until you were at least a lieutenant or reached the age of 30 or something like that. All, of course, gone.
Yes, and quite right it's gone, too.
That would have been
too much.
Yeah.
It does create problems, yes, regardless of the rights or the wrongs of it, it produces problems. And even if you've got a man here, for instance, in Esquimalt, and he's based in Esquimalt, Mum very likely gets restless because he's always going off on these lovely cruises.
Yes, true.
And she has to cope with the whole household and the butcher and the baker and all the bills and stuff like that. She doesn't care for it. So she says, John, you don't sign on. So he says, yes, ma'am, it doesn't.
I'm afraid we'll have to end right here.